Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, bonds. As you've got an announcement, we will have that quiz 4 on Wednesday. It's a review, sort of like everything that you, especially spreadsheet problems, and also just a selection of different problems from the first part half of the course. And it helps you get ready. And then on Monday, we review, and I'll go through those quizzes with you, make sure that you know how to do everything right on them. And we'll do a more general review as well. And once I've told you what I want you to know, I'm going to say you should know this, write it down. That's your study guide, is the first part of the review on Monday. And then I open it up for you to ask me questions about what you want. If you say, well, is this going to be on the exam? And it's not, I'll say, no, I'm not going to ask that. So it's worth it for you to have some questions prepared for me for the second part of the review on Monday. And then, of course, on Wednesday, we have the midterm exam, which is 75 minutes, and you are allowed front and back of a note card, a 4x6 note card. Again, you're allowed the front and back of a 4x6 note card, and you can also bring a printout of your formula, those financial ratios sheet. As long as you don't have anything substantive on that, you can have a little explanation of what the ratio means if you want to on that printout of that ratio sheet. But other than that, that is your printed documents you can have along with you. And as always, of course, this one will be in Respondus. So if you haven't got Respondus working, come to us before that quiz on Wednesday and make sure you have it working by the time of the midterm on Wednesday of next week. So without further ado, we look at the numbers, and the numbers are somewhat grim right now. As you can see, the Dow is taking a plowing, down almost 1.33%. And the S&P 500 isn't down as much at 0.85%. And the NASDAQ is down about the same as the S&P, down about 0.90%. The explanation is pretty straightforward. The financial system of the global financial system is just in a confused state right now because the U.S. Supreme Court found that the tariffs that had been imposed by the White House were unconstitutional. So first, we have to pay all that money in tariffs back. And the companies that imposed the tariffs have to get, it costs them all that money. They're going to have to get reimbursed. Somehow, all of us who actually ultimately paid those tariff costs are going to have, there's got to be a way to do that. So that's going to hit the budget deficit by an unexpected, probably about $150 billion. And now the rest of the world is confused because they thought the tariffs were gone. And then the White House announced that they were going to use another law to reimpose 15% tariffs across all countries. And so the global markets are kind of confused right now. As you see, the Nikkei, just right off the bat, it just dropped down 1.12%. That was reflecting the uncertainty that had happened overnight. And then from there, it just floated because there was no more bad news, certainly wasn't any good news. So the Tokyo Exchange took its hit right off the bat. I'm going up here. China is, the Hang Seng is just roaring upward because there's a lot of excitement about the prospect that they will just simply absorb all of the world's trade simply because they don't do the tariffs like that. And so all these countries that wanted, that can't, won't deal with the United States anymore will go to China for all of their business. And that will just make the Chinese economy explode. And actually all of Asia is going to have a good surge of business in the from all of this. Now you get over here, and it's kind of a mixed message over in Paris at the CAC 40 is up and down, just kind of wobbling, trying to figure out what to do next, what Europe is going to do next, what the European Union is going to do next. And that was reflected. Euronext actually was up a tiny bit, or no, it was down a little bit, but the British pound wasn't up much, but it was up a little bit, 0.12%. So we have taken sort of a broad-based slap across the face in the U.S. markets. And of course, what that means is that when we come down here, gold is just going crazy. It's almost back up to the high it had about a month, more than a month ago. It crashed from there, and as I told you, it was going to come back because the fundamental concern is still there, that the U.S. economy is in serious trouble. And even the Treasury Secretary of the U.S. Said as much in a press briefing yesterday, that we are in for a very hard ride. And of course, that's when gold becomes more valuable, because you get away from soft financial markets and you go for hard metal. And so it is recovering on a very nice basis. And if you think about the world that way and how the flows of funds move from riskier to safer, it's not hard to do well in investments. And I'll just give you a personal note on this, that when I saw gold bottom out, I simply bought and I have doubled what I invested in a matter of just a few weeks. And so that's, you can't have sentiments political, well, I feel that the economy is going to do great because I believe in this politician, or it's going to be terrible because I believe in this politician. You just buy on the rational actions of the investors. You don't try to beat them. You simply try to get as much close to them as you can, maybe in front of them a little bit. So that gives you a good thing there. Now we are also, if you see oil has already gone past the 65.70 for the average crude versus the light sweet. It's now on its way up, slowly working its way back up to, I don't know if you're going to see really bad gas price increases, but you'll see it come back up above $3 a gallon on the cheap fuel within the next month or so. So, you know, it's going to happen, and these are all consequences of the world economy and the U.S. economy and all that. So we'll worry about that as time goes on here. But notice the sector map. As I had told you last week, as a matter of fact, it was funny this morning, there was a news article, more for a popular audience, talking about how the heavy investors are pulling out of technology stocks and moving into more consumer durables and all that, consumer stocks and things and of that nature. And they even mentioned betas in there, as I told you. We saw it starting 2 weeks ago, rotation out of the risky high beta investments, technology stocks, and into safer low beta stocks, consumer type goods, necessities, and all that. And it's now becoming obvious to the more popular financial press, this is what's going on here. Just a quick look over at a couple of numbers, and I won't belabor it today. I'll get through bonds. Let me do this. I wanted to put in Mickey D. They've had some positive press, and so let's see how that, market is not doing well, but Mickey D was up today, really good. Look at that spike on the opening bell. It just popped. It shaved off a little on a little bit of sell-off, but then it is just jumping upward. And there are a couple of reasons for that. McDonald's earnings are coming out, and they announced a major new product in their on their menu. Did any of you read about it? Well, they're offering this ginormous sandwich. It's just a huge one, and it's being received very well by consumers who love that kind of food. So we're in good shape. We're in good shape now. Do they have an earnings show for this one? They're not. Oh, I see. Isn't that interesting? Quarter four, they beat their earnings. See, this was what they estimated, that circle right there. And this is what they actually came in at. And it was a little better than what they thought they would do. And so the market is rewarding them big time for this. And then we'll have the April will be when the first quarter earnings for this year come out. And the interestingly, notice that they are estimating that their earnings will be down for the first quarter. So I would say that probably market participants are going to bet their expectation will be that the earnings will be better than what McDonald's is thinking they'll be. So you should see a run-up of price going into those earnings in a couple of months. And we'll see how that goes. And you all remember that old saying that I gave you before, buy on the rumor, then sell on the news. So in other words, you buy in as rumors come around that earnings are going to be really good. And then maybe the day before or the day of the actual earnings report in early April, you get out because you're not going to get any more from the earnings probably when they report them. But it could be a catastrophe and they report really bad earnings and then the stock price will drop through the floor. So that's why you buy into the rumor of good expectations and then sell out before they actually report because there's too much chance that there'll be bad news and the stock price will drop down from the expectations. It's just a little piece of advice there. Now, notice something. I won't do any holding period return on you for today. Let you go on that. But notice that McDonald's is a low beta stock. It is such a large company with such a loyal consumer base that there's not a whole lot of risk in this kind of an investment in a fast food chain like McDonald's. Now, let me take you over, and sticking in the fast food sector, let me take you over to Wendy's, which has fallen on bad times recently. And as you can see here, it's just dying. That is a large price drop. And we're not even through the day today, but it's just dropping through the floor. 3.75% down for the day. That's very bad territory. But notice that the beta of Wendy's is very low because it's a fast food company with a loyal customer base and all that. But because of its recent troubles, it's just not very attractive as an investment. However, just as a minor point here, it actually has an outstanding dividend. You see that dividend yield? It's 6.92%. So, in other words, you invest $100 in Wendy's, the dividend on that would be about $6.92. So, I mean, you get that kind of interest. You can't even get that kind of interest rate in your savings account or your CD. So the question would be, do you want to take a chance on a stock like this, even though it is definitely falling on hard times? Question is, will it keep falling on hard times? Look at the one-year chart. Look at that. Do you see how it just keeps tailing downward? That's a bad sign. It's just slow. It's almost like you're watching a slow death of the company. It's obviously not going to go out of business, but at the same time, just seeing that kind of a nice slope down, it just keeps going down. And that's not a good sign at all for a company to do that. Let me take you over to bonds for a while. And let me make a real clear thing on the bonds chapter. They're part of the chapter is just memorization, terminology, and all of that kind of stuff. Then there is a part of the chapter that is math. If you do this on your own with formulas and a calculator, it is somewhat daunting. It is, in some cases, it would take, back in the day, it would have taken maybe about 20, 30 minutes to do one problem if you're looking for the bond yield. So the fortunate part is that Excel is outstanding at doing the math of bonds. And I do have a spreadsheet for it. That having been said, on the midterm, I will not hit you with any math about bonds. I might hit you with some terminology questions. I can do that. That's today's lecture. The lecture on Wednesday, I'm going to take you through the spreadsheet because this is the week for chapter 7. But I will ask you nothing about that on the midterm exam. That will be on the final exam and on quizzes after the spring break too, of course. But you don't have to sweat that for the midterm because you've got enough to worry about. And besides which, if we're having the midterm on Wednesday of next week, introducing you to that stuff on Wednesday of this week would not be a good, it would be disastrous as far as your ability to get the problems right. So today's lecture, quite important. Know what I'm talking about. The lecture on Wednesday, we'll pick it back up over after spring break. So don't sweat that. Now I want you to run your attendance radar real quick here while I get it set up. Okay. Bonds represent debt. A company issues bonds. That means it borrows money. The promise is embedded in the bond. So, madam, your company needs $50 million. Now, it could sell stock, which represents ownership in the company, or it could borrow the money, which means that you become a debtor. I am a buyer of bonds. That means I am a lender to corporations. In your case, you want to borrow $50 million, let's say. You issue me $50 million in debt. And I'll get some terminology in here. And so that's what bonds are. Now, I buy it from you, and I might say, you know what, this kind of sucks. I've got better things to do with my money. So I could sell that bond to you, and you become the owner of the debt that she owes. She doesn't talk to me anymore. She actually probably never knew me to begin with. But now she is beholden to you for the interest payments and for the principal amount. And then you later say, nah, I'm good with this. And you sell it to this guy. And then he becomes the debt holder of record. You owe him that money. And that's a secondary market. It's just like the secondary market for stocks. I can show you bond tickers, ticker symbols. They quote, there's a bid, there's an ask, and all of that on them. Let me start with a really basic term here, a set of terms. A bill, a note, and a bond. A bill is a short-term debt, less than 1 year. It has to be paid within a year. You say, oh, I got a bill in the mail from the electric company. No, you actually didn't, because the bill is what you issued. You borrowed electricity from them, and now they're sending you a reminder that you have to pay them that money back. So technically, you were the issuer of the bill. You were the writer of the bill. You were the seller of the bill. And the electric company was the investor, the lender, the purchaser of the bill. And you accumulated a certain amount of debt, 1 month's worth, and now they're reminding you that it's time for you to retire that debt. So they send you a memorandum reminding you of the bill. And it's a bill because it's due in less than a year. Now, a note is a little dodgier. It used to be I could tell you, I would say, okay, a note is 1 to 7 years. But I've seen this term note used for 10 and even 15 year debt obligations. The first time I saw it, and I was a little rattled by it, Netflix issued a ton of debt paper a few years back. And it was 15 year, and they called it 15 year notes. And I thought, well, that's what we would usually call a bond. But it's kind of stretching now, so I kind of have to say about 15 years. Is the outside. And anything greater than 15 years would be a bond. So make sure you know that distinction. Taking it a little in another direction, there is a fundamental difference between consumer and corporate / government debt. In consumer debt, your payments are crafted, calculated, so that you are paying interest from the payment is taken out the interest on the balance every month. And you're also paying on the debt, paying down the balance. Now, the technical terms for this, the interest, when you pay the interest, you are servicing the debt. When you are paying on the part that goes to the balance is what we call amortizing the debt. So your payments, part of it services and part of it amortizes. That's how it works. And you saw those amortization tables in that one spreadsheet, if you remember, how much of the payment was going to the interest, how much was going to the principal and all that. Corporate and government debt works fundamentally differently. Through the life, over the life of the bond or whatever it is, you pay interest only. And then at the end, you make one last interest payment, and then you pay the original amount borrowed. You pay the original amount borrowed. Now, there's one other kind of debt, and I'll mention that in a minute or two. But this is the fundamental difference, that if I borrowed that $50 million, if you borrowed that $50 million from me, let's say it was 8%. We call that interest rate the coupon. And you're stuck with that for the entire life of the debt instrument. 8% is what you're going to pay on the $50 million. You'll pay it twice a year. Now, your book will start out saying, assume it's once a year, but then it'll go to the twice a year routine on it. But that all you pay is 8% times $50 million. And that's $400,000 every year. Now, generally, we pay that in two installments. You get every 6 months, you'll get a check for $200,000. It's semi-annual. It's the way coupons really work. Interestingly enough, if I remember right, if it's in Europe, they do have only annual coupon payment. So it'd be the once a year, the whole $400,000. But then at the end, you have to pay all at once, one last check to me for the interest and the $50 million. You retire it at the end. Of course, the lenders are not stupid. They're not going to hope that you have $50 million to throw at them at the end. They're going to require that you put money aside in something called a sinking fund. So that by a couple of years before the actual maturity, you've already got enough to pay me my $50 million. We're going to insist on that at the beginning, that you, all along, you're preparing to be hit with that $50 million at the end. There is one other kind of debt, and there's actually a consumer version of it, which is terrible. But there is a commercial, a government, and there is a corporate version of it. It's only for short-term debts that it's hardly ever done, unless you're talking about zero coupon bonds. There is another kind. It's a short-term debt. And the government does this too. It's called discount paper. It's called discount paper. It's where, I'll give you an example and I'll show you a little math of it. It's not hard math, but it's where the government does this with their little one-year treasury bills. Their one-year T-bills. They promise to pay you back $1,000 in exactly 1 year. And what you lend them is some amount less than $1,000, a little less than $1,000. So you earn your interest off the difference between what you lent them and that $1,000 at the end. That's called discount paper. The T-bills are, treasury bills are a classic example. Commercial paper, very short-term borrowings by large corporations are usually commercial paper as well. It's Microsoft wants to borrow money. It'll say, in 60 days, I'll pay you back $10 million. And so the lender simply says, okay, I will buy your paper for $9,900,000. $80,000. And so that's why they call it discount. The lender is getting a discount to par, the $10 million. And then, of course, when the lender gets his or her money back, it's $10 million. So they made their interest off the difference between $10 million and what they paid for it. I'll show you an example of this. This is what a treasury auction actually works like. Let me show you the price. The face value. The interest earned. And then the yield. You go to the auction and you literally, there's bidding for the paper. And I go into the auction and I say, okay, the face value is $1,000. Now, by the way, it is always, face value is always $1,000. Unless I say something different, it is $1,000. Regardless of whether it's a bill, note, or bond, we work in increments of 1,000. So this T-bill is going to give you back in 1 year exactly $1,000. So you know, there's people at the auction, and I see that right now I could buy one of these T-bills for $975. So that means that when I get this, the $1,000 back, I earned $25 in interest. So the yield is actually $25 divided by 975. Make sure you don't put $1,000 down there. Your investment was $975. And if I work that out, that's 2.56%. The yield is driven by the price. If there are a lot of people bidding, the price will go up. If there aren't many people bidding, the price will go down. And that is what drives interest rates up and down, is the price of the debt instruments. We don't work in yields in finance. We work in prices. And then the prices imply the underlying rate of return. Let's say we go back to that auction in a year. We got our money. The government paid us our $1,000. So we go back in a year. And we look around the room and we can see that there aren't very many lenders there. That's what's happening now. Our auctions are having fewer and fewer of these heavy-duty, massive investors coming to them to lend the government the hundreds of billions of dollars. So at this auction, there aren't many people bidding, so that's causing the price to go down because there's no demand. The demand is slacking off. So let's say that at the next auction, it's $950. I can get one a little cheaper. Well, the face value is always, I'm going to get back $1,000. That's how these bonds are priced, that are issued. You get $1,000 in a year. Well, in this case, then, what I made was in a year, I made a profit of $50. So this time, if I calculate the price, it would be $50 I made for an investment of 950. And if you work that out, that is 5.26%. This is an example of one of the most important fundamental principles in all of finance. Let me try this. Sir, what happens to the yield as the price goes down?
It goes up.
You have just said one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. We're going to get you into the PhD program real soon. Or not. Okay, the thing though is, price and yield are inversely related. When prices of anything that is a financial instrument go down, that means that the yield expected by the investors is going up. Because as the price is going down, they're going to need more and more expectation of getting a good reward in order to do the investment. So as that price is going down, that means that the yield is coming up. In bonds, that's very important because as bonds in the secondary market, and the price is going to fluctuate. And we can tell what that is saying about the underlying yield that investors are expecting on the bonds. If investors think this company is in danger, I'm going to sell your bond, she's going to sell your bond, everyone's going to sell your bond. Selling is going to drive down the price, which pushes the yield on the bond upward. I won't push out too much, but make sure you have in your notes that price and yield are inversely related. price and yield are inversely related. It is, as you can see, this isn't an opinion. This isn't some idea. This is just arithmetic math. And it's one of those important principles that has just most basic arithmetic underneath it. And you can't argue against it. You can't say, well, I feel, no one cares. This is how math works. 2 + 2 will be 4, regardless of anyone's opinion otherwise. Now, that's about as far as I would go with anything mathy on that midterm exam. I might not even ask you the math question, but I will come back to it in after the midterm, because this is driving markets. Because as investors stay away from bonds, government bonds especially, that pushes interest rates upward. And as interest rates in the economy go upward, the economy slows down. Here's where I come back to what I said while we were looking at the numbers. The U.S. government has just found out that it has to pay back $150 billion. It doesn't have that $150 billion. It didn't even have that included in its budget deficit projections because they were so sure that they could keep doing it. So now, all of a sudden, the government has to borrow a huge amount more money than it was expecting to. So it will pour Treasury paper onto the auctions. Supply goes up, price goes down. Price goes down, yields go up. So this is going to push economy-wide interest rates upward over the next couple of months, or actually over the next year or so. Now, taking that off the table, all of that, and getting back more to terminology. First things first. Bonds come in so many different flavors and varieties. It's almost, and by the way, I use the term bond as a generic for almost for any kind of debt paper. I say bonds, but it applies to bills and notes as well. But especially, bonds work like this. A company can raise money. Of course, ideally, a company raises money by selling good products and making a profit and growing its free cash flow. However, if a company needs a lot of money in a short amount of time, it can sell stock, which is what we call equity. In other words, it's selling ownership in the company. That's what common stock does, and preferred stock and all that. Or it can borrow the money. That's debt. Now, the funniest thing is that debt is cheaper than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity. Until it isn't, but we'll keep within normal ranges. Because you see, the debt holders, they get the first claim to free cash flow. The company can't give a dividend until it's made its coupon payments and paid its bills. So it has to pay the debt holders. Because the debt holders, if you don't pay, if the company doesn't pay, if you don't pay me my coupon, I will go right to court and turn your company off and liquidate its assets. They're gone. That $400,000 check, if I don't see it, I'm right on the phone with my lawyers to go to court and claim everything in your company, and I will sell it. And you will be out of a job as a CEO, and your company will be gone. That's how harsh it is. The debt holders have the prior claim to the free cash flow. Therefore, their position is not as risky as the shareholders. they have to be paid. If you don't pay the debt, the shareholders their dividend, if you don't make the stock price go up, the worst they can do is cry. That's all they can do. You hear these shareholders, well, they haven't given us a dividend. I'm going to sue them. Really? You're suing yourself because you are an owner of that corporation that you are going to sue. As a shareholder, you are in a bad position. You just have to hope that you may get a dividend check, that you might see the stock price go up. But the dividend holders don't have to worry about that at all. They will shut you off if you don't pay them. So the debt holders have the prior claim, and the shareholders have the residual claim. In other words, after all of those lines on the income statement, there at the very bottom is what the shareholders get. Because above that was wages and salaries, accounts payable, and all taxes, interest expense. You see that those lines all were above prior to the profit line. And the profit line is where the company gets to have money to plow back in to grow the stock price, has money to give to the shareholders as dividends. That all comes after the debt is taken care of. Debt is cheaper than equity. First of all, debt has a prior claim, so it's less risky. But there's also another reason. You see, because interest expense is tax deductible. So I, as a corporation, you get to deduct that interest you paid before you pay taxes. So that actually effectively reduces the coupon that you're paying, because some of that money you're saving in taxes off from the revenue. That's the layout of the debt. Here's the next thing. Debt, remember I told you about investment banking. When you issue stock, a syndicate of investment banks gets together and they work out, they'll buy the whole issue of stock, and then they'll sell it later in the secondary market. Debt works in a somewhat similar way, except that debt has a formal document. It's the loan papers. The investment banking syndicate, they talk to their money people and say, okay, we got this company, wants $50 million. And then a contract, an agreement is set up. It's called an indenture agreement. This is essentially the equivalent of, you go to get a car loan. You sit across from the finance guy at the car dealership, and there's paperwork and all this, and you sign papers, they sign them. Or a house, the same thing. That's the same thing. You're actually engaging in the negotiation, if you want to call it that, for a loan. And the indenture agreement is the same thing, except in the corporate set idea. The indenture agreement has all of these details. Who is it who's borrowing? Who the lenders will be? What the coupon, the interest rate will be on it? Just a whole bunch of covenants, as they call them. The covenants are all of the details, the address of the borrower, the lenders, all of that kind of stuff. There are always special, well, there's one that's always in there. It's called the bond trustee. the lenders are not going to just lend you that $50 million. I am going to assign someone, perhaps an attorney, a law firm, someone who's going to be there at the board of directors meetings, who's going to be the naysayer if you do something that puts my interest at risk. Classic examples of that, this, are dividend restrictions. You're not going to give out dividends if that puts my payments at risk. You're not going to give a special dividend to make your shareholders happy at the annual shareholders meeting, because that's my money you're doing that to. You're not going to do highly risky projects, because you see, if they win, your stockholders are all happy and giddy. I don't care. All I want is my flat interest check and the balance principal at the end. I don't care if your stock price goes to the moon, if you're on the cover of Fortune magazine. A bondholder doesn't give a rat's ass about how incredibly successful you are. All I want is for you to be successful enough to pay my interest payment. That's all. And have the money to pay off the face value of the debt at the end. That's all that matters to us. So they're going to put someone in there that represents my interests and has a no on any great ideas that I might have, that the company might have, that might put my fixed interest payment at risk. So there's a bond trustee. Now, there are other things, too, that can happen in a bond. There are bonds that are callable. That might be in there. A callable bond means that at some point in the future, I, as your lender, could call my debt in. If something you do pisses me off enough, I could actually say, give me my $50 million back right now. You think you'd never see that? There's a call provision in home loans. If you don't make two payments on your mortgage loan, I call your loan in. It's called an acceleration clause. You signed agreeing that I could do this. Okay, you still owe $85,000 on your home. You've missed the last two payments because you lost your job. I'll send you a notice that you owe the entire $85,000. Payable in 30 days. Wait, I want to get the payments. I want to get your payments to you in a couple of weeks, I promise. Too late. I initiated the acceleration clause. You have 30 days to pay me the $85,000, and then I bring in the sheriff's deputies, and they move all your stuff out to the curb, and they kick you out, and they kick your dog on the way out. You got it? That is a callable loan. And they are sometimes, there are a provision that could be in the indenture agreement. Now, there are other ones, too. Like there are puttable loans where the borrower can pay off early. A borrower would pay off early if interest rates go down and you could get that money at a cheaper rate from someone else. That's actually done in consumer loans where there's a clause where you can actually refinance a loan. If interest rates fall enough, you might have an incentive to refi the loan at a lower rate. You're putting the loan back to me as the lender. There's another one, which is oddball, convertible. A convertible loan has a weird, is kind of odd. It could play both ways. Suppose that suddenly your stock just goes way up in price. If I have my side of a convertible, I could convert at a specific, some set price, my debt into stock. So I could get in on that, the action. The other side would be if you have a convertibility clause. Suppose that the stock price is going to hell, you're in trouble financially. if you have a convertibility clause, you could turn my debt into stock and get out from under the interest payments. And there I am stuck with this worthless stock of your company. That could happen. A couple of last ones here for you. It's a couple of names. Let's try. There are commodity bonds. The most classic kind is a gold bond. These are bonds that pay in something other than cash. They might pay in gold. They might pay in silver. I swear I saw one that paid in grain long ago. But those were a thing that we did after World War II. We promised Europe that we would rebuild it because the whole continent was basically a pile of rubble. And so in order to get the money together so that we, the United States, could rebuild all of Europe, we issued these bonds that paid off in gold from Fort Knox. That turned out to be a real disaster because it turned out that the people, the investors who bought these gold bonds, a lot of them were old families in Europe. So that when the bonds came due, we had to give these you know, ancient rich families gold out of Fort Knox, lots and lots of it. So in a way, we ended up doing all this work only to give them our gold, doing all this cleaning up and rebuilding Europe, and just for the privilege of giving them gold from Fort Knox for what we had done. There's another one that's kind of popular off and on, foreign bonds. Foreign bonds are bonds that pay in a currency other than the country's own currency. It was more than a few years ago, and it happened while I was down in Central America teaching, and I do that every summer, that the government of Panama, of the Republic of Panama, needed a lot of money on the order of a couple of $1 billion because they needed to upgrade the airport, which they were becoming such an international hub. Everything was going through that little place where the canal is. And they wanted to rebuild these old decrepit cities that had fallen apart from the colonial era. And so they issued bonds that paid in US dollars. And I mean, the funniest thing was that who has hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in of US dollars? Well, of course, China does. How would China have them? Because every time we import a Chinese product, we export to the People's Bank of China dollars. So they accumulate as foreign reserve in the People's Bank of China. And they have all of these, and so what did they do? They snatched up that entire debt issue within 5 minutes. That opening day when the debt was available for investors to buy, they just went in and subscribed the whole thing in one shot. And of course, that is something that now makes that critical strategic little narrow strip of land essentially under the supervision, under the watchful eye of the investors who are the People's Republic of China. So there you go. That's a foreign bond. Now our companies, if I go over to Europe and I want to do DFI, that's direct foreign investment in Europe, what I would do is I would actually issue bonds, borrow the money to do the investment in euros for one really good reason. That way, there's no exchange rate risk. In other words, euro exchange rate doesn't matter. It's in euros. We will make money in Europe in euros, which will stay in Europe Why would we issue it and pay in dollars if we can do it in euros? That's a classic foreign bond. Now there's a variation on this called the Yankee bond, where foreign countries issue bonds denominated in dollars. If I'm not mistaken, most of the Japanese automakers have issued at one point or another Yankee bonds because they're going to make money in the United States in dollars. So why not have debt? You pay the coupon payments and the principal back in dollars. They make the money here. They make it in dollars. So they use that to pay back their borrowings that they do. So Yankee bonds are a thing too. And there are other ones too, but these are some of the flavors you get in bonds. Oh, one more thing. I should point out the difference between a mortgage bond and a debenture. A mortgage bond is collateralized with something. Collateralized with a factory, a fleet, something is actually, so if the company goes under, that debt holder gets claim to the asset that was used as collateral. But those are actually fairly safe bonds, because even if the company goes tap city, you've got, I as the lender, I just go in and say, that factory, that's mine. It says so in the indenture agreement. So that's a mortgage bond. That's why they call home loans mortgages, is because you are backing the loan with a hard asset that the investor, the bank, can take back. A debenture is uncollateralized. They are riskier because there's essentially they have to wait until the mortgage bondholders are satisfied. And if there's any scraps left, they get it. That's enough for today. Go home.